SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, a 3D live video journal, which is interactive with discussion. In association with SNI, Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, is pleased to present another in the SNI Digital series on controversies in spine surgery. This program was presented on December 27, 2024. Nancy Epstein is the person presenting this lecture. She's the professor of clinical neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York in Stony Brook. And she's the editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International. The first talk in this two-part series is entitled Lessons from Malpractice Cases in Cervical Spine Surgery.
For today's series on controversies in spine surgery, again, we have Nancy Epstein, who is a professor of clinical neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York in Stony Brook. She's the editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International, has had an extensive experience with spine surgery going back 40 years, and has probably one of the highest rate of publications in regard to spine surgery cases in the world. So, Nancy, you're going to talk today about lessons for spine surgery from malpractice cases. That's right?
That's right. And I'm also going to emphasize to everybody that, especially if there are any lawyers who check into this, that all cases are actually de-identified. All these cases are like done. So there should be no documentation other than there is one case where we definitely had permission from the patient to reveal some of the information, including the diagnostic studies, as well as one of the other lawyers in one of the other cases gave us permission for monetary reimbursement information. Okay. But the main thing for today is, you know, hey, you can see on the cartoon here, the doctor's ready to maltreat you now. You know, this is lessons learned from these malpractice cases to try and improve the medicine, the neurosurgery that we're delivering to our patients, because it's still all about the patient and how we can improve patient care. And the only way to do that is to do it honestly and in a straightforward fashion and confront any of the mistakes or errors that are made. I'm going to just briefly go over cervical anatomy. Jim and I have done previous presentations of cervical and lumbar going over the anatomy in greater detail. This is just to give everybody a quick refresher course. I'm then going to introduce an unnecessary procedure. Epidural steroid injections are actually not FDA approved, and they have no documented long-term efficacy, but they're being done and in many instances required by many insurance companies before surgery is approved. And I'm going to tell you one of the major complications arising from that. Another case just representative of unnecessary surgery being done, but also operations unnecessarily and wrongly being done in ambulatory care centers, and that there are criteria for operating in those centers where you don't do operations with patients with major comorbidities in these settings. You do them in a hospital. Then I'll review four cases of negligent cervical surgery. One, the surgeon actually took a bite out of the spinal cord. Surgeon pistoned a trial spacer into the cord. A surgeon did a wrong level, multi-level anterior discectomy infusion where OPLL required a multi-level corpectomy. And another case where the surgeon actually did a multi-level corpectomy for OPLL, but had no plan to deal with the CSF leak that they should have anticipated based on the pre-op CT. And what I'm going to emphasize here is that five out of these six cases resulted in quadriplegia and one of the patients died.
Wow.
So these are major cases. These are not minor perturbations. This is not, you know, questionable of a focal radiculopathy. Just to remind you, you're looking at an AP view of a image of a cervical spine. You've got the vertebral bodies, and then you've got the transverse foramina, and the vertebral arteries are going to come through here, obviously. Then next to it, you have an axial view, the vertebral body itself, the spinal canal containing the cord. Here you have the lamina on both sides. You have the spinous processes where they join together. And then obviously bilaterally, you have your facet joints. And again, don't forget your vertebral arteries and those transverse foramina. And that's why certainly with your CT scans, you want to know how wide that canal is, the distance between those vertebral arteries to make sure you're not off center and going right into one. In terms of the anatomy, again, here, let's add some of the soft tissues. You've got the vertebral body anteriorly. Circumferentially, you have the epidural space here, the anterior epidural space, followed by the dura containing the spinal cord, followed by the posterior epidural space. And then posteriorly, you're going to have the spinous processes and lamina. Intraoperative monitoring, essential, critical. When I was president of the Cervical Spine Research Society in 2001, I had looked at a series of cervical cases, but done both in New York State as well as California. And the one commonality is quadriplegia resulted in 60% of those cases was due to a one-level discectomy infusion. It was not just the multi-level complex procedures. So again, I'm just emphasizing to people, consider using intraoperative monitoring for those one-level operations. Helps keep you out of trouble, helps keep the patient safer. Why not use something that's going to improve patient care? Well, maybe because you don't want somebody watching over your shoulder, but if you need somebody watching over your shoulder to tell you when you're getting into trouble, basically it should be something that you use. Anteriorly in the cord, you're going to deal with motor evoked potentials. Posteriorly, the somatosensory evoked potentials, and then you have the nerve roots on either side, so that's where your EMGs are going to come in. Again, if you just look at the soft tissue of the cord itself, anteriorly, you've got the motor evoked potentials. Posteriorly, you've got somatosensories, and then you've got the nerve roots. Now, in the nerve roots, EMG is for the motor root anteriorly, and the SEP for the posterior root. Well, guess what? When you try and do an operation from behind, especially when you're taking out a disc posteriorly, you may see that there are two separate roots. The anterior root is often white and it doesn't have a dural, dura encompassing it. And don't take out that inadvertently thinking it's a cervical disc because it's not. It's your anterior motor root may not have a dural investment, so be careful. Okay, so let's talk about the first case. This was an unnecessary cervical epidural injection done on a relatively young patient. She had a normal MR. She had a normal neurological exam, okay? The epidural, typically, these take just 3 minutes. It's amazing. You can read through the charts. Bam, they're in there, they're out. Interventional radiologist did the procedure, left the facility within minutes, okay? In the postoperative care unit, the patient complained of severe pain and the onset rapidly of numbness, tingling, and weakness was largely ignored for several hours. Ultimately, though, the patient was transferred to a hospital. The MRI scan took time to get. Huge epidural clot being shown, and I'll show you an example of that, but not the patient's specific films. Surgery was delayed. Why? Because the surgeon wanted to watch to see if the patient was going to get better, was going to, quote, observe the patient. Finally, the patient was completely quadriplegic, and then he operated, and then post-op, the patient essentially remained quadriplegic. This case ultimately settled. Lessons learned included avoid unnecessarily performing epidural injections. And if after these epidurals, patients develop deficits, get a timely MRI scan and bring them to surgery in a timely fashion. This is just an example of what a posterior epidural hematoma can look like on an MRI scan. And you can see here, a cephaloid caudate anterior to posterior. Here's C2, 3, 4, 5. Your posterior epidural hematoma, massive, is sitting right here. This wasn't the patient's films, but is similar to the films that this patient had. Just to remind everybody, the MR scans for cervical discs, it can show an anterior or anterolateral disc, which is appropriate for an anterior discectomy infusion. And here's an MRI scan, large anterior and anterolateral discal component here. Should be done from the front. You're not going to get this safely from the back. Okay, but you also have foraminal disc herniations as illustrated here, and you have lateral foraminal discs as illustrated here. Laminoforaminotomy should be your procedure of choice here. Some may do an anterolateral approach as well, but just remember, you do a laminoforaminotomy, you do not have to do a fusion. you are not going to encounter a carotid or a jugular vascular injury. You still can get into the vertebral if you go out lateral enough. You're not going to encounter typically a CSF leak, which is much more frequent from anteriorly. And you're not going to have all those nerve palsies, recurrent laryngeal nerve palsy, making your patient hoarse, getting the phrenic nerve, paralyzing the diaphragm, getting the sympathetic chain and ending up with the Horner syndrome, getting the vagus nerve, et cetera. The list goes on and on for the anterior complications. So here's an example of what a CT scan is going to show you. Ventral spur seen here on your illustration, and this is what it can look like on your non-contrast CT exam. And then here's just an example on your Milo CT, where here you have your anterolateral component, more lateral and foraminal, and this is perfect for doing a laminoforaminotomy because here's your lamina. You do a medial facetectomy, you do a laminoforaminotomy. You can actually visualize that nerve root. You can put a downbiting curette underneath that nerve root, picking it up with a ball tip dissector and do a really good job. By the way, if you try and do these anteriorly, oftentimes you're going to miss the most foraminal component, especially if they're multiple burst fragments. Plus, you're not going to have to do a fusion. Well, again, when you bill, you're going to bill less, and that's maybe one of the unfortunate motivating factors. Here's a second case. This patient also had an unnecessary procedure, but this was an unnecessary anterior discectomy and fusion. Okay, the MR was normal. The patient had no indication for doing this operation. There were multiple medical comorbidities, and the medical comorbidities are a contraindication to doing surgery in an ambulatory care center. So this is typical for older patients with major comorbidities. This patient was morbidly obese, had additionally to that diabetes, hypertension, alcohol abuse, sleep apnea, COPD, and other factors can contribute to that, but especially the morbid obesity, a big contraindication to don't do it in the ASC because guess what? You're not keeping these patients overnight. You're not watching them for a day or two to anticipate all the complications that they can get into. So ambulatory care center, guess what? This case was done very late in the day. They just observed the patient for 2 hours. The minimum required is 4 to 7 hours. This patient should have been transferred to another institution, to a hospital. Patient, by the way, got home, severe pain, onset of numbness, tingling, weakness. Within 2 hours, that patient was dead. And the patient in this case died of a hematoma. So here the lessons learned is, again, avoid unnecessary surgery, not only the unnecessary procedure, which was the epidural I just went over, but avoid ASC in patients with major comorbidities. So here's just an illustration of a post-op wound hematoma, which is what this patient died from. By the way, if you're in any facility and your patient after an ACDF suddenly develops shortness of breath, swelling of the neck, red blood coming from the drain, open the patient right then and there, and then bring the patient back to the OR and reoperate. Don't hesitate, don't delay, and don't bring them down for a scan at that point, just reoperate. Okay, because otherwise you're going to have outcomes like in this patient, which was an extremely unfortunate situation. Okay, so case three. Well, you see a pituitary over here. When you put a pituitary into a disc space, cervical disc space, lumbar disc space, you know, you want to put it in closed, and then you want to open it up, and then you want to close it again. You don't want to put it down too deeply. I can remember as a kid in kindergarten, my best friend had a lumbar disc herniation done in the state of California. Her dad was like in his mid-30s. They got into the aorta and he died. Why? Probably because exactly this. They had the pituitary in there. They opened it all the way. They went right through the annulus and right into the aorta. Well, in this case, what they did, and I'm showing you a bite being taken, a non-spine surgeon did a multi-level ACDF just one day, had not done very many in his career, okay? He literally took a bite out of the spinal cord. We know that because that's exactly what the resident at that OR table stated in his deposition. It's not in the OR note, but that's not a surprise. This patient woke up quadriplegic, yet the surgeon made sure that there was no stat postoperative MRI scan and no reoperation ever done on this individual. Patient remained a quadriplegic and this case settled. But lessons learned here, again, spine surgeons shouldn't be doing the spine surgery, or spine surgeons should be doing the spine surgery, non-spine surgeons should not. And really, it's best to always tell the truth. Surgeons who create fictitious operative notes and try and willy-nilly change their depositions, big mistake, because guess what? There are other people in that OR, including your first assistant, who are going to tell the truth. And in this case, the assistant said, I remember that patient jumped almost to the ceiling as soon as that bite was taken. Also, postoperatively, do what's right for the patient. And if it's a new deficit, do your stat MR and CT. Yes, Jim.
That's the kind of case you just settle that immediately. I mean, there's no point going through anything else. It's just going to wind up in the same situation, but worse.
Yeah, this case actually went through everybody's deposition before they finally settled. And it was really, and the patient was obviously devastated. This was another case. The surgeon pistoned a trial spacer into the spinal cord. Okay. There was no intraoperative lateral fluoro imaging, as was required based on the instructions as to how to use this instrumentation system, and I'm going to show you that briefly. There was
By pistoning, you mean, so the people in other countries are listening. Oh. It means you plunge it further into
that. Exactly. It's like taking a knife and just stabbing somebody.
Okay.
This metallic device was literally not just placed into the disc space because there was no lateral fluoro, but it was basically plunged right into the spinal canal where it damaged the cord. Post-op, the patient was quadriplegic. Again, no studies were done, no reoperation was done, and the patient remained quadriplegic. And this case settled. And the lessons here were tell the truth like we just spoke about and do what's right for the patient. Get a stat MR and reoperate if you can. In this case, a reoperation would likely have consisted of doing a multi-level laminectomy just so that the patient had some room to swell into. Okay, but this is emphasizing that surgeons must be familiar with the products that they're using. In this case, the manufacturer in their insert said, warning, trial spacers do not have a depth stop. An image intensifier should be used to visualize and check the position during insertion. In this case, nowhere in the operative note was there any mention of having used that image intensifier or fluoro while this device was being placed? One of the experts later brought this up, and it was then communicated back to the surgeon, who then came back and said, oh, yes, of course I use this, and I just didn't put it in there because it's just routine. Well, nobody actually believed that. But these are the devices that are used. They have slightly, some are green, blue, purple, yellow, because of the different shape. One's hyperlordotic, one's lordotic, one's parallel to the end plates, and one's convex. So they're different shapes and different sizes that are used. And basically, this is where it's pistoned or pushed right into the disc space. And here's your AP view here, and here's your lateral view. But that's where it's supposed to stop. But what's saying is that the device itself does not have an automatic device in there to make sure that you stop short of going into the spinal canal. So that's exactly what happened in this case. And again, it emphasizes that when you do an ACDF, a one level or a multi-level, you're going to do your anterior discectomy infusion, but posteriorly you should have safety ridges that are there posteriorly to prevent any pistoning of any interbody device, much less, you know, in this case, you know, your trial spacer. So many people constantly are asking, if you're doing a multi-level cervical operation, you know, what are you using to determine, do you go anteriorly or posteriorly? And one way of sort of collecting together all the impressions is to use something called the K-line. But it's going to incorporate, as you're going to see, lordosis, hyperlordosis, kyphosis, et cetera. So if your pathology is anterior to the K-line, and the K-line, by the way, is a line that's vertically drawn between the mid-aspect of C2 and 7, okay? But with a positive K-line, you can do anterior-posterior 360 surgery, Whereas if it's behind the K-line, coming from anteriorly, and you've got kyphosis, you're going to need anterior surgery. So this is just a way of repeating exactly what I'm just saying now. Here's your positive K-line. That's the line, mid C2 down to mid C7. You're going to draw it on every patient. Okay, sometimes it's going to come outside the spinal canal. But this is just emphasizing that your pathology in this case is in front of that line. So this is the positive K-line sign. Here, the negative K-line. Here's your K-line, same K-line, mid C2 to 7. Your pathology goes behind that K-line. So basically it's telling you, okay, you want to get this pathology and look at the kyphosis here. There's lordosis over here, but kyphosis here. You're going to probably have to go anteriorly. Okay. So if you have a positive K-line, the safest choice is to do a posterior operation for all the long list of complications that I've, or adverse events that we've just described for doing an anterior procedure. With a negative K-line, you're likely going to have to go anteriorly. So again, positive K-line, a good lordosis, anterior posterior 360 surgery, but choose posteriorly when we can, because it can be the safest choice. The negative K-line with the kyphotic patient, you're likely going to have to go anteriorly. So here, just to reemphasize, you have a positive K-line. All this pathology is in front of this K-line, mid C2 to 7, okay? You're going to do a laminectomy. Here's your laminectomy. That's where your K-line was, but here your spinal cord is going to move anteriorly away from all these ventrally situated osteophytes. So the pathology here remains, but your cord migrates nicely away from it, okay? Here, on the other hand, you have the negative K-line, where here's your K-line, basically, and what happens here is that that kyphotic deformity is going to go right behind that, and you're not going to get any decompression if you do something from behind, because the cord's going to be tethered over the anterior disease. It's just as if you take your finger and you pull a rubber band over your finger, okay? Your finger is preventing that rubber band from straightening out.
Very good explanation. Really good.
Okay, so here again, anterior K-line. Here's your OPLL pathology here, hypothetically, or any pathology. Anterior to the green line, that's your K-line. Okay, here, the MRI scan shows multilevel spondylosis. Here's your K-line, or where it would be. Do a posterior operation, because guess what? You've got an excellent lordosis. Here is a CT scan. It's actually a Milo CT scan. You can actually see the dye. But here, great idea. There's your K-line. And do a posterior operation, because again, with that lordosis, you remove the posterior material, the lamina, spinous processes, etc. You're going to have plenty of room for that cord to migrate away from that anterior pathology. On the other hand, you have a negative K-line. Here's your kyphosis. Okay, here's, I'm just figuratively drawing in a lot of anterior pathology, and then there's your K-line. So it's clearly going behind that line, and you have a kyphotic patient. So here is an MR, a little hard to see. Here's your K-line. That hypo-intense material on that MRI scan happens to be multi-level OPLL. And why do I know? Because if you look carefully, it is not just opposite the disc spaces, but you see how here, this is C3. It starts midway up C3 and goes all the way down here, almost to like C5, 6. But do you see that behind the body, particularly of 4, all that hypo-intense material is there? So the OPLL continues behind the vertebral body. And here is a CAT scan of a similar finding. And again, you can see the K-line that's drawn in here, a little more difficult to see perhaps. But here's C2, C3, C4. And here, you know, you can do an anterior corpectomy and fusion and basically decompress things. And if you do the axial image on these and you draw your K-line, you're going to see a huge hunk of that OPLL is behind that K-line. You are not going to get that out from behind. You are not going to decompress that patient by doing a posterior operation. Preoperative CAT scans are very important to get in patients with cervical disease, especially if you in any way suspect ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament. And these are the three dural signs that you're going to see in many of these cases. This is what's called the single layer sign. It can be continuous with the posterior aspect of the vertebral body, and it can be a huge mass, It's going to vary in size, a single layer sign. Years ago, I described what's called a C sign. So you have a single layer of material, but you see the way it's going off to the side. And here you have a C because dura becomes imbricated in this. If you try and go for this from anteriorly, or you have to go from anteriorly, you know, be anticipating a CSF leak, because very likely you're going to get one. And certainly use a microscope. It's just absurd in cases where they don't. These, on the other hand, are two double layer signs. And what do they have in common? Well, here you see the posterior aspect of the vertebral body, and then there's a hypodense line. That hypodense line, that is your dura. So all of this other material, this hyperdense material, is intradural. And here, same thing. This is your dura. This is hyperdense OPLL inside, calcification inside your dura. There's no way you're going to decompress that without having a massive CSF leak. You have to anticipate it and be ready to treat it from the get-go. And these are patients where I'll show you later, you have to do a prep and drape from the get-go with anticipating that you're going to do a wound peritoneal shunt and a lumboperitoneal shunt. So here is a patient over the age of 65. And this patient was diagnosed by a non-spine surgeon as having multiple discs on an MRI scan. Oh, by the way, this surgeon had never done a corpectomy. So I'm preparing you. He's going to do a multi-level discectomy. He did not obtain any preoperative CT scan because he didn't realize that this finding on an MR is consistent with OPLL. So he had no diagnosis and no anticipation that OPLL would be present. He certainly never spoke to the radiologist, who in this case was a neuroradiologist, who questioned whether or not there may be OPLL. These are not the exact images of this patient, but you can note that that OPLL mass that I'm showing you, hypo-intense, okay, some of it comes behind the K-line, and you can see that there's very hyper-intense change in the cord itself here. So again, this is what you're going to see on the MRI scan, okay? The surgeon diagnosed discs on the MR, again, a non-spine surgeon. There was no CT, no pre-op diagnosis or anticipation of OPLL. He did the wrong operation, a multi-level anterior discectomy infusion. Look at what that's going to do. Just take this level, for example. All of this OPLL is back here. Before you know it, the surgeon's going to find himself intradurally and inside the spinal cord by mistake. And some will end up with anterior spinal artery injuries as well. But to do a multi-level discectomy here, here, and here, guess what? You're leaving all of this disease behind the vertebral bodies. I've seen some surgeons claim, oh, well, I just use an upbiting curette. I get behind the body and I can remove it. Doesn't work. Gets a massive CSF leak and typically damages the cord. But in this case, leaving that residual OPLL behind this body, somewhat behind this body, stretch the spinal cord over the residual OPLL, and post-op, the patient was quadriplegic. Again, recurring, you know, image, recurring problem. No post-op MR, no reoperation, and the patient remained a quad. This happened to be an eight-figure settlement, so we got clearance to state that. So what did that patient really need? Patient needed a multi-level anterior corpectomy infusion. An anterior corpectomy, in this case, would have freed the cord from the OPLL. And here you can see the corpectomy graft, putting from here to here, C2, C3, 5, 6, 7, down to T1. Okay. But no, did a multi-level anterior discectomy infusion, and the purple is supposed to be the OPLL left behind those vertebral bodies during that dissection. Might have gotten out some of the OPLL at the levels. Actually, typically they go in, they almost immediately get a CSF leak, and then they start to back out. If they're smart enough to have intraoperative monitoring present, the intraoperative monitoring also drops out, and that tells them that they're doing the wrong operation. What you should be doing at that point is converting to a multi-level corpectomy, not just a discectomy. And the other mistake they make is, oh, they go, they do the multi-level, they do one level at a time. They do a discectomy here, and then they put in a graft without completing decompression and dissection of the OPLL at the other levels. That's even worse, because then you're stretching the cord, making it ischemic, and pulling it over OPLL that has not even been removed yet. So these are some of the sequential mistakes or errors that are made in these cases. But stretching the cord over the residual OPLL in this case certainly was responsible for severe quadriplegia.
Can you go back and let me ask you a quick question?
Yeah, sure.
I'm sitting here thinking about, you see OPLL in the calcification of the dura, or that's what's happening, right?
Right.
And you see that in the cervical spine. You don't see it in the lumbar or thoracic spine. Am I right about that?
You see it, but less frequently. The order is cervical, followed by thoracic, followed by lumbar. But you can get significant OPLL in the thoracic spine as well. It's just less frequent.
What causes that? It's genetic.
It's genetic. The HLA site, et cetera, there have been lots of hypotheses. It runs in families. It can occur sporadically, obviously, but it's a very, very high prevalence in families.
Interesting. Okay.
So in case five, it's an example where a multi-level corpectomy, this is what should have been done. Okay, you do a multi-level corpectomy, you put in a strut graft, and then you put in your anterior plate. I can remember doing a corpectomy early on. This was in the early 2000s. We did C2 down to T1, and we had to have Asculap send us stat, a plate that they hadn't even released yet. It was the longest plate that they had. It was a dynamic plate, and we placed that anteriorly, and then you can do a multi-level posterior fusion. If you're doing a two-level anterior corpectomy infusion, you need to do a posterior fusion because the rate of that two-level corpectomy extruding is about 10-20%. If you do a three-level or more corpectomy and you do not do a simultaneous posterior fusion, the rate of extrusion is about 50%. I wrote an article on this back in 1998, and Alex Vaccaro also wrote an article on that as well. So again, circumferential surgery really comes into place with these multi-level corpectomies. So here is another case, middle-aged patient, multi-level OPLL, did both the MRs and the CT scans, had a negative case sign, decided to do a multi-level anterior corpectomy infusion, had not done many, but it was from C3 to 6. Now, they did have a CAT scan, and the CAT scan showed clearly that OPLL was to and through the dura, but they failed to plan and anticipate that intraoperative CSF leak. And now why I'm saying anticipate, because I'll show you shortly, they wrongly treated this leak with, they threw in a chunk of, lyophilized dura, and then they put DuraSeal anterior to the spinal cord. Now that's one of the main contraindications for its use because it caused a huge compressive mass. I think also during this operation, they just directly damaged the cord during the corpectomy. But in any case, this patient postoperatively was quadriplegic. The patient has, these are like what the patient would have had preoperatively, the multi-level OPLL seen on the CT, as well as here on the MRI scan with a high signal in the cord, seeing particularly at the 3-4 and 4-5 levels. Okay, so now I'm just gonna show you, because we actually wrote this up, we did get permission to show the postoperative CAT scan in this case. And here you can see the postoperative CT. It shows a block of material, C3 down to C6, okay? But guess what? A stat CAT scan is gonna show you the bony information. It's not gonna give you enough information as to what's happening in the canal. It might show you that the graft is extruded into the canal, but it's not gonna show you any changes in the cord. You really need to do an MRI scan to get that information. So, in this case, they did an MR. It was delayed for many hours, okay? And this is the actual MR scan, and look at that. That is your anterior dural compression. That is your anterior DuraSeal. Now, the radiologist correctly read that as showing massive anterior compression, and you can see how the cord is displaced posteriorly. Your compression is anterior. It's not posterior, okay? But the surgeon wrongly did just the laminectomy, okay? Postoperatively, the patient remained quadriplegic, did not repeat the MR, did not reoperate, and just left that anterior DuraSeal in place. The patient remained quadriplegic, and this was actually a seven-figure settlement. This was actually during COVID. But in this case, really, your radiologist was laying it out for you, where the problem is. Go back, take it out. But, he had the severe leak and didn't know how to deal with that. What should really have been done in this case is the surgeon should have anticipated that there would be a huge intraoperative CSF leak. Then when you're doing the operation, you can prepare and drape. See, the incision is marked here. And the, you know, right over the liver, you're right, you're drawing where you're going to put that catheter. And here I already, you can already see the dotted lines. Dotted lines are going to go the, you know, the subcutaneous spacer is going to go right underneath here. And you're going to go down to the peritoneal cavity and you're going to put in a wound peritoneal shunt intraoperatively. That's what should have been done here. Prep and drape for that wound peritoneal shunt. And then postoperatively, you can put in additionally a lumbar drain, or you can decide to do an immediate lumbar peritoneal shunt. The problem is if you put in a lumbar drain, still that patient is still going to be probably using that lumbar drain rather than the anterior drain itself. And a lumbar peritoneal shunt placed immediately was the way I basically ended up doing these. And you have to use a horizontal vertical valve, where every time the patient stands up, the pressure will go way down and they'll end up with a subdural. But this is one of the old unishunts that we used to use. There are many other shunt catheters that can be used. Now you can track the shunt catheter directly from your neck exposure to the abdomen, and always put that dome of that shunt catheter near the anterior incision, so you can always tap it to try and confirm, is it open, closed, etc.
Can I ask you a question? I don't know if this is sensible or not, but here I am at surgery, and I'm concerned that something's happened to the operative space and so forth. I put this stuff in there. I want to know, is there any way of injecting some radiographic dye locally and taking a lateral portable spine? I know what's going through the surgeon's mind. They say, oh my God, I got to get an MR right after surgery. And it's lined up and they got to wait and it's anxious moments. Is there anything you can do to image it immediately?
I mean, to image the extent of your CSF leak? Because
you got CSF coming out of it, you inject dye in the area. I mean, it's going to go many places, but if it gets into the spinal fluid and surrounds the cord, at least you get some image, you would know. Is that a wild idea or not very good?
I think it's been used in some cases. I mean, the fact that, you know, it's just right in front of you, it's perfect for doing a myelogram. I don't think it's necessarily going to help you in this case, because you see the massive CSF leak that's there. You know that you have open dura. And your question is, how are you going to end up treating that? And you're going to need to do that anterior wound peritoneal shunt. And it's got to be a very low pressure system so that you know there's no hesitation to use that as an external conduit. And then when you're doing your lumbar drain, actually, sometimes, you know, so much CSF has poured out, you're not going to have an easy time getting in that lumbar drain initially. But I think using the dye anteriorly, I think most people would not use it. You know, you always worry about arachnoiditis. You worry about, in this case, seizures if it gets intracranially. So I think most of the time we probably wouldn't use it.
Okay, good answer. Thank you.
So let's just summarize what we've been talking about for the cervical procedures. The summary is pretty grim. We have 5 quadriplegic patients and 1 patient who died. These are not minor procedures. These are not minor adverse events. These are not minor errors. These are major egregious errors. And one of the main factors here is if a problem, an adverse event occurs, do something about it. Okay, because without pursuing something that might reverse that patient's status, they're going to remain quadriplegic for the rest of their lives. Here, what happened? The unnecessary epidural injection, that settled. It settled out of court. But boy, everybody in the world went through, you know, depositions in this case. And the unnecessary death, that case also settled. Negligent cervical surgery took a bite out of the court that settled. Everybody was deposed, as I was once told by a defense attorney. Everybody wants to be able to bill, so those lawyers are going to make sure that everybody in the world is deposed before a settlement is proposed. Surgeon pissing the trial spacer into the cord. There were also, in some of these cases, a question: did the resident do the surgery rather than the attending surgeon? And the the wagons really circled around that to protect the residents, even though in some instances, some residents in their ACGME forums might have attested to the fact that they did a major portion of that operation. Surgeons wrongly doing a multi-level anterior discectomy infusion, especially a surgeon who had only done one level corpectomy in his life, and that had been in a supervised setting. And that was a case that settled for eight figures. And the other was the multi-level corpectomy, where the CSF leak was completely mismanaged, and that settled for seven figures. And actually, you know, if it hadn't been in the midst of COVID, it probably would have gone to court and would have been many more figures than that. But it's not just that they settle these cases. It's not just the monetary configuration. It's what happened to these patients, because there was not enough, you know, it's like a mental error in baseball. So many of these errors could have been avoided had the person involved, the surgeon involved, said, hey, you know, this operation is not for me. You know, I'm a skull-based surgeon. I'm a peripheral nerve surgeon. I'm a vascular neurosurgeon. I'm not going to take on doing a spine operation, even if, you know, it's going to be good for my RVUs in my institution. And then when these adverse events occur, don't just assume it's going to disappear because you ignore it. And don't lie on your operative reports. A lot of these are templated reports, and what's in the operative reports are fiction compared to actually what went on. But other people in the OR are going to know what went on, especially your first assistant, and somebody else is going to tell the truth.
Well, let me ask you a question about this. You've seen a number of these cases. Have any of these cases that you know have gone to trial and essentially been dismissed?
Okay, well, the answer is no. But in case number five, oh, this should have been number six, but anyway, the case that settled for eight figures, that actually went to court for one day, and then they settled.
That's my point.
These cases were not dismissed. These were not defense verdicts. And I know what you're getting at. Like, some of these go to summary judgment where they say, well, you know, but really in this case, the surgeon should be taken out of the equation because it wasn't their fault, and it's just the extent of the disease, and OPLL is a difficult operation, and it has a high incidence of spinal fluid leaks and neurological deficits. In short, you know, looking for excuses, oh, well, it was just within the standard of care. But the answer is, should quadriplegia be within the standard of care?
Well, my point is that it's at some point, and there are different lawyers that get into this. You've already talked about the fact that everybody's looking for money. At some point, the surgeon himself is really at risk here, and you just settle it. And it would seem that that's more reasonable than stretching it out. You only antagonize the family, you antagonize the other side. The jury is obviously not sympathetic toward you, but more to the patient. It would seem reasonable that, yes, I did it, and it's a mistake. Those mistakes happen, but we just have to settle the case. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But I can tell you that there are so many instances where the insurer comes back saying, you know, look, the doctor has the final word here. In some cases, the doctor has no word over what's going to happen. In other words, the insurer can say, look, their policy doesn't cover this. The policy is that we as the insurance agent can choose to pursue it or end it or settle it or whatever. But in other instances, the surgeon has the final word as to whether they settle or not. And if they refuse to settle, then they have to, abide by what they're saying. I mean, I remember one case, it was in New York, and I was asked by the surgeon, this was the defendant, you know, he said to the insurance company, look, if Epstein reviews this case and thinks that I should settle, I'll settle. And I reviewed the case, and it was clear as day that he had to settle, and he did. But there are a lot of other surgeons that it's the arrogance and the inappropriateness and the insensitivity as to what they did wrong, or that they did anything wrong, or that they could ever do anything wrong. That's what you're up against. The main thing that you're looking at is you have in well, five out of these six cases, quadriplegic patients, and they're waiting for years to have some financial relief so that there's a way to take care of them.
Okay, so let's say I'm the surgeon and I say, look, I made a mistake, let's settle it. The insurance company may have a different approach to the problem. Is that correct? And want
yes.
to take it to court.
And they also have documentation that you wait every year that you wait in a patient who's quadriplegic, there's a certain frequency of those patients dying. And at that point, it's going to cost the insurance company less.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, well, Jim and I were talking about this, you know, how would you have judged these cases? Should these have been, you know, defense verdicts, plaintiff's verdicts, settlements? And the other is, what should you avoid in the future to not be in this same position with either a friend, a relative, or yourself? You know, avoid ordering unnecessary epidurals, avoid unnecessary anterior discectomy infusions, and performing operations in ambulatory care centers in patients with who are older with other major comorbidities. Avoid taking a bite out of the cord. Make sure that pituitary is not, you know, open and you're not just plunging in, you know, blindly. Avoid pistoning that trial spacer into the cord. Read that insert for that specific product. If there is no stop for that interbody spacer, then, you know, you've got to be super careful and use lateral fluoro. Avoid doing the wrong operation. If you need to do a multi-level corpectomy, and this is not something you know how to do, hand the case to somebody who knows, okay? And avoid using Duracil anterior to the cervical cord. This is obviously in the product insert, should never have been used here, was left in place and left the patient with a major deficit. And that brings us to negligence of our surgery.
excellent summary there. And a lot of messages there. One last question before we go to the lumbar.
Yeah.
How much power does the doctor have to say, I don't want to go through all this, I want to settle this? Or is this basically because it's a hospital, you got everybody else into it, he or she can't do that?
I think, you know, it's, you have often multiple defendants. You can have a surgeon who may be employed full-time by the hospital.
Oh.
And then they're under the hospital. Many times your neurosurgeons or spine surgeons or orthopedic surgeons are independent practitioners. So they are a completely different set of insurers. And lots of times, you know, the emergency room physicians and hospitalists and other consultants may not be full-time employees of that hospital. So the hospital is often one of the defendants, but there may be multiple other defendants involved in that case. So it's a conglomerate of people who are involved in terms of making these decisions.
So it's not that simple.
No, but there are some cases where they will drop the surgeon from the case because the surgeon settled, but the case remains against the hospital or the internist or, you know, the radiologist or somebody else.
Okay, good points, good lessons.
Nancy lists 9 references after these talks. For your records, take a screenshot of each slide as it appears for your records. Slide 1. Slide 2. Slide 3. Slide 4. Slide 5, slide 6, reference 6, reference 7, reference 8, and reference 9. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended as use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health problem, or as a substitute from seeing a licensed medical professional. At the end of the video, please fill out your rating on the rating scale located at the bottom of the program on the website. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions, comments, or requests for CME to ausman@snidigital.org. The foundation supporting these programs believes there are many ways to learn. Two of them are supported by the foundation. One is Surgical Neurology International, known as SNI. Its web address is sni.global. It's a 2D internet journal. Nancy Epstein is its editor-in-chief. The second journal is a new video, live video journal of neurosurgery, interactive with discussion. Its web address is snidigital.org, and it's available 24/7, 365, worldwide. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories over a 14-year period of publication. It's the third most widely read 2D journal in neurosurgery. In SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, after 10 months of publication, is now in 145 countries as a new 3D video journal. Purpose of the foundation is to help people throughout the world, and it also sponsors a medical news network for the purpose of bringing truthful medical and science news into the world. This program is copyrighted by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation in 2024. All rights are reserved. We hope you enjoyed the program. Thank you for being here.